It's Wednesday, December 16th, 2015, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, Serial's back, but the mystery doesn't seem to be there. We'll talk about what makes Bo Bergdahl's story so much different than Adnan Syed's and whether audiences will stick around for it. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia asked a question during an affirmative action case that left many in the left-wing press, such as Mother Jones and The Hill, labeling him a racist. Was it fair, or were his statements taken out of context? And Star Wars fans scramble to get their fill on the newest film, and so too is the media. But we're going to start with last night's GOP debate in Las Vegas, the first since the terror attacks in Paris and San Bernardino. Mike, you had told me you had a lot you wanted to talk about from the debate last night.
Well, I'm interested in a couple of things. I mean, one is the obvious stories of how was this framed? What were the narratives coming out of the debate? And it seemed like every media organization, print, broadcast, online, was saying it was two things. It was the battle between Donald Trump and Bush, and it was the battle between Cruz and Rubio. And so you saw those. That was basically the frame for the whole thing. And it's probably about right. But the other thing that I found it really interesting was the way that the coverage on the networks has changed. CNN now has this cast of thousands analyzed. I mean, literally, here's Anderson Cooper with 10 people talking about the debate. And then they have to go to another set in Las Vegas where they have Jake Tapper with another 10 people sitting around talking about it. And it's just really kind of boring to me. Compare that to what Fox News was doing, and it looked like a perfect mirror image of the battle for the soul of the Republican Party. So they have Bill O'Reilly, of course, on right after the debate, and he has on, you know, some journalists. He has Britt Hume from Fox News, he has Brett Baer, and then he has Charles Krauthammer, who is, you know, this old style, very intellectual, conservative commentator on there. And they're all talking about Trump and saying, but the guy's making up stuff. And he's saying things like, oh, well, I'd kill the families of American-born terrorists. And O'Reilly's going, well, yeah, that's okay. What do you mean that's okay? He's lying about this stuff. And he says, well, but he knows it's not true, and he's only saying it for effect. Well, isn't there something wrong with that? No, because he's fighting the bigger battle of trying to blow up the corrupt Republican regime. And that's kind of the fight that you see going on among the presidential candidates themselves. And it was just interesting to see it reflected in Fox News' own coverage of the event.
Well, I think what's starting to happen here is they're going to try to figure out, and when I'm going to say they, I'm talking about the Republican Party. They're going to try to figure out what is it that we're going to do once we head into the primaries? Where are we going to go with this? We're going to have to figure out some sort of way to deal with Donald Trump, because he can't be our nominee, because all the polls show that out of all the candidates that they have, the credible candidates that they have, he's the one that does worse against Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. And this just will not do when it comes time for the general election.
I mean, I guess the other thing about the whole business with Trump is that the media are starting to assume now, as they've, I mean, the narrative's slightly different, but it's the same as it's been for a while. Trump can't possibly be the nominee, but now they're playing it out. Well, did you see that Rubio and Cruz were basically talking about each other and attacking each other, not attacking Trump? Because they just assume, as we, the media pundits, assume, that it's going to boil down to them. Hmm. I guess the other thing I thought was really interesting, and I mean, I torture myself to watch the undercard debate as well, right?
I had it on. I admittedly had a hard time.
But there was at least as much news, I think, being made out of that undercard debate. I mean, first of all, you had Mike Huckabee saying something that I found really, really strange and disturbing, which was basically he was saying that mosques should welcome, should invite, should encourage the government to come in and monitor their activities there if they have nothing to hide.
And one of the things he was trying to say in doing that, too, is that they're public places. Well, actually, they're not. That is private property.
That is private property. And that part I don't understand, because if you say, should churches do that? I
mean, churches,
Christian
should
churches, synagogues
should
do that?
Temples, right, of other religions? No.
I mean, if that happened, then I'm telling you, based on Huckabee's past, right, statements, mm-hmm, he would do a complete 180 on that.
But on the other hand, since the undercard debate was viewed by fewer people, there was less at risk. You had Senator Lindsey Graham, who is the most hawkish member of these folks, talking about what we need to do against ISIL. But he also gave the most full-throated defense of American Muslims and saying how terrible it was, the things that Trump and others were saying. And yet most people wouldn't have heard that if all they listened to was the top nine, because they were much more muted for fear of alienating Trump's voters.
Yeah, I think part of the problem here, and this is where I do fault the media, is that there's so much fear-mongering going on, and there's so much Islamophobia going on, that I don't see enough, the media doing enough to combat that in the way in which they ask these candidates questions, and they ask politicians questions, they ask government officials questions that get them to start talking about, is there a way we can ratchet this back? The president has tried to do that, but I don't think he's getting much help from other politicians. I know Hillary Clinton has tried to do some of that, but I still don't think it's enough.
And if I could just say one more thing about the media, I would say that kudos to Wolf Blitzer and the other two moderators from CNN last night, because we can criticize one question or another, but they seemed to ask relevant questions. They kept the candidates on track. Blitzer had to shut down Cruz a couple of times, and they actually had a substantive debate about foreign policy. So, you know, compared to some of the other debates, I thought we actually learned a few things from that one.
So there's another crazy story coming out of Las Vegas, ironically enough, the scene of last night's debate. The Las Vegas Review-Journal is the biggest newspaper in the state of Nevada, and we have no idea who owns it. And I don't just mean the three of us. The only people who know who that newspaper's owners are the owners. Late last week, the paper was sold for the second time in less than a year for $140 million in cash. CNN's Brian Stelter, hosting his program Reliable Sources Sunday morning from Las Vegas ahead of the debate, asked Nevada political reporter John Ralston about it.
Not only are the owners not refusing to reveal themselves, you have reporters at this newspaper tweeting yesterday how outraged they are that they don't know who owns their newspapers, that they don't know what kind of conflicts of interest might exist. How many major newspapers do you know of, Brian? We don't know who the owners are.
Zero.
Zero.
Absolutely zero. I've asked other journalism experts. They don't know of a case like this in the past either.
Monday, staffers orchestrated a Twitter campaign calling for transparency, tweeting a link to the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics, that code, of course, having an entire section on transparency, ownership, and avoiding conflicts of interest. This is a head-scratcher if ever I've seen one.
Yeah, they're right. I mean, I went back once you alerted me to this to try to see if there was anything like this in being a historian, and I have not, at this point, been able to find anything like this where you have a news organization, a news operation, a newspaper that no one knows who owns. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, did they have to file any paperwork? But I guess since it's a company, it's a privately held company, that they can keep it private.
And if it weren't so serious, it would be really hilarious to watch the paper's own reporters trying to dig up the story. And at least one time, a line in the story that was attributed to an upper management person was stricken from the story by upper management before it was published. They have I think that the people in the newspaper staff have a pretty good idea now. They're starting to zero in on Sheldon Adelstein, right? The billionaire hotel casino owner, supporter of very right wing Jewish causes, Republican financier. From everything they can gather, he's more likely than not the person. But the way they did this, they set it up with this LLC in Delaware. And so the reporting requirements are so lax that it's going to take a leak or something to put two and two together.
Well, I mean, they started out when the staff reporters at the journals began looking at this. At first, they thought it was the Koch brothers, and because they had been talking about trying to engage and do these types of things in terms of getting media operations with different papers across the country. And I think in going in that direction is where they may have stumbled upon Adelstein, because there is a little bit of a connection between those two operations.
Well, and they found that the guy who's sort of representing this, I shouldn't call it a shell company, but this LLC was staying at Adelstein's hotel, the Sands in Las Vegas, when people were interviewing him. There's other connections that they've been able to establish. And I think at some point we'll get to know the story. And I really think the bigger piece is, why would they want to keep it secret. And why would, frankly, why would a group of investors want to buy a newspaper for almost half again what previous purchasers paid for it just less than a year ago, with the newspaper industry being what it is? It can't be to make money. There has to be some other sort of motivation, leverage, influence, something.
And I think this is what the reporters are worried about, is the fact that, you know, number one, they paid more than what the paper is worth. And they did it right after it had been sold to another company. They're worried about what's going to happen here in terms of this newspaper operation, because it's clearly not about making money. It's clearly going to be about having some sort of influence, or at least that's what they're concerned about and they're afraid of. So that's just their jobs. It's also about the journalistic credibility of this newspaper.
And to a certain extent, whether or not it's Adelstein or somebody else, it looks a lot like, it parallels the sort of rise of dark money groups that we've seen, you know, since Citizens United. You can give all the money in the world and not have to reveal who you are.
Right. What bothers me here is that the lack of transparency on the part of what's supposed to be perceived as a mainstream news operation that covers local news. What is this? What kind of impact is this going to have on local news coverage in Las Vegas, which has always been problematic because of the type of town that it is and the gambling
and
operations
other influences.
And other influences and that sort of thing? This just throws one more monkey wrench in that, in terms of the public in Las Vegas being able to get news and information that they can trust.
Well, okay, here's another one for you. Last week, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the case of Fisher versus the University of Texas. It's an affirmative action case in which Abigail Fisher, a white woman, says she was denied admission to Texas's flagship university because of her race. The university says her grades and test scores didn't pass muster. Why are we talking about it here? Well, during the hearings last week, Justice Antonin Scalia made a comment that, according to some reports, caused many in the courtroom to gasp. Here's what he said, according to court transcripts. Quote, there are those who contend that it does not benefit African Americans to get them into the University of Texas, where they do not do as well, as opposed to having them go to a less advanced school, a less slower track school where they do well. Some left-leaning publications such as Mother Jones pounced, calling Scalia a racist. Others likened him to the drunk uncle who can always be counted on to say something that either could embarrass or inflame. There are others saying he was throwing a devil's advocate argument to the attorneys in the case and trying to dig a little bit at what their arguments were.
Well, I think part of what's going on here is that Scalia was referring to a specific line of academic research that has gone back and looked at and tracked African Americans and other ethnic minorities in higher education and how they do at elite universities as opposed to, say, lesser known universities. And that research has shown that they do well in that. So he was sort of referring to that. But there's other research on the other side that pretty much debunks what Scalia was quoting. But that argument has come through, and I'm not surprised it came through in this case, because it came through in the first case, because this is the second time that this case has come through. It came through doing Bakke. It came through doing the University of Michigan case a couple of years back. So this has come up before. So that's sort of what he was referring to. And so, a little bit out of context, I think the way in which Scalia made the statement, made the remark in today's heightened environment involving race, sort of blew that up. And a lot of reporters went directly to that and didn't quite make the connection between that line of research and that line of argument, as opposed to the line of argument that the University of Texas that was bringing up.
Yeah, I mean, anybody who follows the Supreme Court over the years knows that Scalia, one, he's a very bright, deep thinker from a conservative point of view, and he's also the Supreme Court's bomb thrower. I mean, he attacks his colleagues. He uses very colorful language in his opinions, whether they're dissenting or the majority opinions. And what he said may have sounded inartful to some, racist to others, but it wasn't like he hadn't thought about what he was trying to say. And he was bringing up this whole mismatch theory, you know, that Ernest was talking about. And he, if you go through the quote, if you listen to the transcript, he even refers to the fact that, you know, this is what came in some of the evidence or the testimony in the case, and that's why I'm asking the question. To me, what I take from all of this, besides, you know, whether or not he's a bomb thrower or he's insensitive or whatever, is that we need more journalists like Adam Liptak from the, you know, New York Times, another, or this first you had on the blog, Lyle Denniston from the SCOTUS blog. we not only need more reporters who dig in deep to these court decisions, we need people in the audience, we need the public to actually care enough to read that kind of information, because it is a very important topic and it's very subtle arguments and there's a lot of research on both sides. And yet all most people are going to do is take the Twitter blasts or the quick headlines, the quick and dirty, you know, take on this story, and they're not going to get any of that.
I mean, this is one of those things where, especially when you start talking about Supreme Court cases, and we've had this conversation before, where you really need to have a longer version of the story that people can look at. It can't be, as you were talking about, it can't be a quick Twitter blast
or a single sound bite, which is one of the arguments exactly. against having recordings in the Supreme Court to begin with.
Exactly. And it really goes back to the point that some stories, especially stories like this, we really need to have more information out there to the public so they get a better idea of what's going on. And we aren't so quick to sort of cast dispersions or label people as being certain things without having all the facts in the proper context.
Okay, so let me ask you this. Were you surprised to wake up Thursday morning and find an update from Serial in your iTunes? I was, and it was a little like a holiday present none of us were expecting. And now we know for certain Season 2 does focus on Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. My guess is if you're a fan of the program, or if you follow the news at all, you know he's the soldier who spent almost 5 years in Taliban captivity after walking away from his outpost, and now he's facing court-martial. I have to say, part of what makes Season 2 so different, to me at least, from Season 1 is that, for the most part, we know Bo Bergdahl's story. This isn't the unfolding of the murder mystery that we had in Season 1 with Adnan Syed.
I think we know part of the Bo Bergdahl story, and one of the reasons that I'm kind of looking forward to the Serial treatment of it is that we could see an exploration of some aspects of it we haven't heard. We haven't heard from Bergdahl, and in the very first episode, that's what we get. Mm-hmm. The one thing that concerns me about it, though, is that this is really not the original work of Sarah Koenig and the staff of Serial. They did such a marvelous job with the Adnan Syed murder case. But this one, they're basically relying on a screenwriter, Mark Boal, who wrote Zero Dark 30 and The Hurt Locker. He got interviews with Bergdahl in preparation for doing a screenplay for a movie about Bergdahl. And so the screenwriter shares this audio with the staff of Serial, and that's where we're at least early on getting most of the audio content. How much original reporting did they do? How captive are they going to be to Bergdahl's own take on this? He's, of course, facing a court-martial and is desperately hoping to get some sympathy from the public.
Yeah, he's going to need it because right now he's facing life in prison.
Yeah. So it's too early to say. I agree with you that this doesn't have the same, it couldn't possibly have the same impact as the first Serial, because here was a case no one had really heard about except for a few family members. It was a case that was serialized in a way that hadn't been done online for a long time. So the first time's always going to be a bigger bang.
See, and part of me almost worries, I don't know if you guys remember that show from the 90s, Murder One, murder courtroom serial,
right.
that first season, so captivating. And then that formula of that we're going to get you at the end, second season kind of petered out.
I think that's going to be part of the problem. And plus, this is an ongoing case. So, I mean, as you're watching it on Serial, you're also going to be hearing about what's happening in the courtroom during this court-martial. So how are those two things going to play out in the series?
Of course, I mean, you could argue that in some ways the first season of Serial was an ongoing story too, except for the fact that the journalist producing Serial and a lot of other people who were immersed in this, invested in it, coming up with their own legal theories and their own evidence and all this stuff, actually allowed Syed to get a hearing that could lead to a new trial. So that show had impact in a lot of ways, not the least of which was because it was so new and different. You had a lot of people who would not invest themselves emotionally in the Bo Bergdahl story because they don't get to own a piece of it like they did Syed.
Well, there are some developments this week in another long ongoing legal case. Word out of London that Ecuador and Sweden have reached an agreement, and the Swedish will soon have the chance to question WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Let's remind our audience, he has been living in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, hiding out from rape allegations that have been waged against him in Sweden. So what's likely to happen next?
This is going to be interesting. I mean, two of the charges mm-hmm. that were filed against him have been dropped because of the statute of limitations that ran out. He's been in this embassy for about 5 years now.
Three and a half years.
Okay. Yeah. So the statute of limitations on those two have ran out, but there's still another one that the statutes don't run out until 2020. So he's still got to deal with that. I think what Sweden wants to do is figure out some sort of way to get from up under this. So they're hoping that by being able to go in and interview him, that they can get his side of the story or whatever his lawyer is willing to let him talk about and try to match that to the other evidence that they have to see if there's some sort of way they can work out an arrangement whereby he's not in Ecuadorian prison. Because I think Ecuador is probably getting a little bit tired of hosting
their
him
house
at
guest.
This point. Yeah.
I mean, you also have to say a whole lot is going to depend on what the Swedish authorities make of that interview, because if they still decide to follow through with the charges and seek extradition of him as they had, then it raises the whole issue that Assange has claimed to be fearful of all along, that he needed asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy because the Swedes were really, in his perception, just trying to get him there so they could extradite him to the United States, where we would take him up on the much more serious sort of treason charges that we would likely file against him.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. I think that's one of the things that his attorneys are going to be concerned about, is what happens if there's some sort of plea agreement worked out between him and Sweden where he leaves Ecuador. Now, once he walks out of there, you know, who knows? I mean, the United States could come after him. I think they're also the Great Britain is also involved in terms of wanting to have a conversation with him about some of the things that were leaked back during the WikiLeaks investigation. Mm-hmm. So he's still got a lot of legal issues he's got to deal with.
And I do think we should still focus on the fact that just because he claims that the sex he had with these young women in Sweden was consensual, at least one of them has mm-hmm. convinced a prosecutor to think about filing very serious charges against him. We don't know that he's innocent, and that's why this case is still playing out.
Well, our director, Travis McMillan, sent me a link to a column from the Dallas Morning News. Its claim, NBC has either forgotten or ignored the lessons from the Brian Williams debacle and is crafting its marketing of Lester Holt in exactly the same way it did Brian Williams. Commercial spots showing the nightly news anchor interview Syrian refugees standing in the streets of Paris and in San Bernardino, telling the stories, and then there are the folksy promos like this one, which appears online only.
You know, when I was in the Today Show, I got to play with a lot of different artists. I have to tell you, playing with Earth, Wind, and Fire just doesn't get any better than that. Yeah, it was cool. I like to fly simulators, airplane simulators, on my computer. I have some very sophisticated ones, and I will sit there and program the flight management computer, and I'll fly from, you know, Los Angeles to San Francisco. That's really nerdy.
So you've seen the promos, you've watched the video, read the column. What do you think? Is NBC kind of heading down that same look at our star path in its promotion?
Well, I'm not sure. Because one of the things I'm wondering is who's in charge of this. Is Lester Holt in charge of his image, or is NBC in charge of his image? And if this is Lester Holt, I don't have as much of a problem with it. But if it's NBC sort of pushing him and saying, you've got to do this, then we start running into some issues, because I think in the Brian Williams case, it was both Brian Williams and his own ego and NBC saying we need to craft this star in the hopes that he, you know, his star power will usurp the problems we're having in terms of ratings and that sort of thing. So it's that's my only concern mm-hmm. here.
I have to say, I mean, it's nothing unusual about a television network or a local television station pumping up the personality of their anchors. I mean,
everybody does it.
Everybody does it. And this one of the pieces you linked to on the blog mm-hmm. made it sound like, well, it was kind of NBC's fault. Like, they haven't learned their lesson. They're setting Lester Holt up for another Brian Williams moment. But I think most people should try to remember Brian Williams was to blame for his lies and his exaggerations, not NBC News. And most people who have spoken publicly about Lester Holt say that privately he's a very honest, low-key, good guy. So, you know, if that's the case, then NBC and we have nothing to really worry
about. And I think one of the things you can look at in this regard is that Brian Williams sought out a lot of avenues by which to build his brand.
The 30 Rock spots, the late night spots.
You don't see Lester Holt doing any of those things.
Absolutely true. Well, Friday, it's the day just about everyone except me has been waiting for.
And we're counting down until that major event that is every American civic duty to take part in, the new Star Wars movie.
I'll admit, I have never seen any of the Star Wars movies and pretty much have no desire to, but if you go online, turn on your TV or radio, open a newspaper, it's pretty much everywhere. Now there are Star Wars toys, Star Wars clothes. Well, here's Colbert again.
I'm so excited for the commercial tie-in possibilities of the new Star Wars movie. Like this actual ad for a product that so seamlessly integrates Star Wars that I thought at first it was a new trailer.
There has been an awakening. Will you be enticed by the dark side? Or embrace the light side. Discover your destiny with the CoverGirl Star Wars collection. The Force is strong. Feel its power. The CoverGirl Star Wars collection. Which side are you on?
Oh, the forced marketing integration is strong with this one. Bravo, CoverGirl. This is the perfect makeup collection for girls who like Star Wars, but not enough to realize that this has nothing to do with Star Wars. With this new collection, CoverGirl's offering 3 light side looks and 3 dark side looks. They were previously available only in containers that didn't say Star Wars. And the makeup comes in such intergalactic shades as lilac, gold, dark purple, silver, and red. And for you non-super fans out there, those are all colors that exist in the Star Wars universe.
Then there's the news coverage. Bloomberg Business has a data breakdown on the Force that, if we're to be honest, has more bells and whistles than the AP's very important look at slavery in the Thai shrimp trade. Time Magazine has a feature that lets you read any of its articles in the style of the opening credits scrolling up the screen. The Los Angeles Times wrote a style guide to make sure staffers spell Wookiee correctly. For the record, 2 O's, 2 E's. Can we just tip our hat to the fine folks at Disney for the PR machine they have going on here?
I think we should, but you have to remember, they have a huge stake in this game. I mean, we're talking billions of dollars, not just the movie itself, but the rights to the Star Wars universe that Disney bought. So this movie, there's a lot riding on this movie, and there's a lot riding on J.J. Abrams to bring home the bacon on this one.
I've got to say, though, I mean, I wouldn't worry so much about Disney. Can they really screw up the Star Wars universe any more than George Lucas did with the 4th, 5th, and 6th movies of that franchise?
I wouldn't know.
And everybody says J.J. Abrams has done a really good job with this. It's seen it. So I'm feeling kind of confident. Now, for you, Amy, I have to say, though, I'm surprised because you watch a lot of movies and a lot of TV, and you remind me of a certain character on television, Corey Big Hoss Harrison from Pawn Stars.
Uh-oh.
They actually made fun of him for not being, you know, watching the Star Wars movies. He called it a green puppet, a girl kissing her brother, and a bunch of stuffed animals running around space. But even he eventually, in that episode of Pawn Stars, watched the movies if for no other reason than to avoid real work. So I think you've got to figure this one out.
There's a Star Wars binge in your future.
I'll do work. Well, that music, it means we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today. There's lots more information on our links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments, questions, see what we'll be talking about next time, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, to Maya Jackson, our technical director, and Pat Akers for handling the audio. We're going to be taking a little break for the holidays. I think I'll be watching Star Wars. We'll be back with you, though, on Wednesday, January 13th. I'm Amy Simons, and for Mike McKean and Ernest Perry, well wishes for a safe and happy holiday season.